So my name is Magalie Billen. I'm a professor at UC Davis, and for those of you who don't know me, I work on the dynamics of subduction. And I mainly focus on the dynamics in the upper mantle. But today I'm going to try to extend both my knowledge and your knowledge of the processes of slab dynamics as they go into the lower mantle and interact with the structures that we see there. So this is the title of my talk, which was actually given to me by the organizers, and I knew I was free to change it, but I decided I was happy with it because it basically allows me to sort of set up what we want to do in this talk. So slabs, of course, are the tectonic plates, which are composed of crust, a Hartzsprungite or a residual layer from melting, as well as the cooled mantle that basically forms the lithosphere part of the tectonic plates. Fate is an interesting word. I don't think we're talking about the destiny. That might be a little bit too personal when talking about slabs. But rather, what we want to understand is, what is the expected normal development of slabs? Is there an expected normal development of slabs as they go into the lower mantle? And then finally, stirring is actually a very appropriate word for the sort of range of topics that I'm going to talk about today. Because if you remember from Carolina's talk, stirring is the mechanical process of motion in the fluid and how you mechanically are changing or moving bodies around in the fluid. So we're not really getting to the point of extreme mixing, right, where diffusion properties and changes in rheology and things will really help to homogenize a system, but rather really I'm focusing on the period of time in which slabs are still acting like slabs, okay? And you'll understand a little bit more about what I mean by that as we go through the talk. So the goals for the talk today is to build an understanding of the basic physics that determines dynamics so that, first of all, you can appreciate the importance of modeling with observations, right? How do we actually use the models to interpret and understand our observations? But I also would like to help you to be more critical of those models, okay? And the way that I'm going to do, sort of model the talk today, is to try to compare and contrast what we know about how slabs deform in the upper mantle compared to how they deform in the lower mantle, okay? All right, and so the talk will have three parts. The first part will be focused on just an overview of the observations, hopefully a brief overview so that I can get into the rest of it. The second part will focus on fundamentals of slab dynamics. And when I mean fundamentals, I mean really, I'm going to go into, I think there's only one equation, but really talk about sort of balance of forces and how those forces control ultimately what a slab does, all right? So I'll talk about upper mantle, which I describe as being more advection dominated. Things move fast, okay? Versus the lower mantle, which you end up being either viscosity or buoyancy limited in terms of how you move through that system. And then finally, I'll try to link the observations to the dynamics by showing you five different examples of how slabs are interacting in the transition zone, the upper mantle, the mid mantle, and the core mantle boundary. Okay. And as a reminder, you may stop and ask questions anytime. I do not have 100 slides, I have 55. So hopefully that will allow us time to go through this at a good rate and have time for questions and discussion. Okay. All right, so let's start out with some observations, and we'll start out with the basics, okay? So our first order observations of slabs comes from seismicity. We know from seismicity that slabs are one-sided. One plate subducts, not two plates subducting towards each other. That may seem really obvious, right? But it didn't have to happen that way, okay? And it's actually probably very much controlled by rheology, right? Slabs tend to have a very shallow dip near the surface, something like 5 to 10 degrees, and then they bend and steepen as they come out from underneath the overriding plate. This is telling us something about the strength of the slab and the work that has to be done in order to bend the slab into the mantle. If you go look a little bit deeper down, we can follow seismicity into the transition zone, to the base of the transition zone, but not all slabs are seismically active, okay? And so this is where it's important to also incorporate seismic tomography in looking at the shapes of slabs in the upper mantle as well as they go into the lower mantle. So when we look at slabs in the upper mantle, we see that there's a whole range of slab dips from basically very steep. This one's almost 80 degrees to more shallow dipping slabs. I don't show it here, but some slabs, actually here, no, I have the Marianas. Some slabs may actually be overturned at the transition zone. Java's another example. And the slab thickness that we seem to observe in tomography is similar to the lithosphere thickness, okay? There's not a huge amount of thickening, so we don't think that these slabs are just sort of being squashed, right, as they go into the transition zone. This is a nice summary figure from Foucault's paper looking at sort of a bunch of different slices of different subduction zones. And you can see, as you go through these, that there are all different kinds of geometries, okay? We have slabs that appear to go flat above the transition zone, okay? Some that go flat underneath the transition zone. The bottom line here is 1,000, the middle is 660, and the top one is 410, okay? Some slabs may be being flat above the 660 or actually below the 660, all right? But other slabs appear to go straight down, Mid-America, the Curals, Mariana, today, okay? And so that geometry is telling us something about the forces that are acting on the slab, the motion of the slab, and numerical models are one tool that we can use to understand what it is that actually controls and defines that geometry. Slabs can also have complex 3D geometry. They can have holes or tears in them. This is a slice through the Japan Izubonin slab. Here's Japan, okay? So this is at 300 kilometers, 400 kilometers, and almost sort of 450. And you see that there's a gap in the seismic, in the tomography here, I think this is P wave velocity. And they've also looked at the focal mechanisms of earthquakes, which show basically how the slab is deforming in that area, and they've concluded that there's actually a tear or break in the slab, okay? So even though these slabs can stretch and also have strength, they may also actually form gaps or holes, okay? And that's going to change the way they deform. And in some cases, they may actually completely break off, okay? Those are kind of extreme events, but important. The 3D geometry can also be quite variable along strike, right? If you look at, for example, Tonga, at shallow depths, the seismicity basically follows the shape of the trench. But as you go deeper down, you see that there's actually sort of a curling of the slab, right? This is shallower, this is steeper, okay? The deep earthquakes are closer to the shallow earthquakes. The Kuril, Japan, Izubonin region is interesting. This is all the Pacific plate, right? One plate that's subducting. And you go from very steep, steep slabs down here to the shallowest, longest dipping slab in the mantle underneath Japan, okay? And then it bends right back again in the Kuriles and becomes very steep again. And so understanding why it is, the plate here is basically all the same age, right? But it's going into the trenches at different orientations. What is it that controls that geometry? Okay. And we also can see some holes. I'm willing to draw a circle around that in Tonga and call it a hole because it has about 100 times more earthquakes than over here, okay? That's not a hole in the slab. That's just not seismicity, okay? And that's an interesting question, right? Why is there so much more seismicity in Tonga compared to other subduction zones? All right, and we might come back to that when I get to the examples. Yeah? I'm sorry, that's depth.
Yeah, no, but like the dark blue is what depth?
Just above the 660.
Oh.
Okay. The 3D geometry also changes with time and also depends on the length of the trench in which the subduction zone is, in which the slab is subducting. So we tend to see that short trench lengths result in more curved slabs and more curved trenches. So see the example, this is from Scotia, the Calabria arc, which has started actually really straight and maybe bent and curved over time. But in South America, this is a very long and relatively straight subduction zone, okay? You also see that these smaller subduction zones have a lot of trench motion, right? The trench is actually moving towards the subducting plate in time, it's retreating. Whereas this very long subduction zone seems to be relatively stable and sitting in place. And there's been some models, actually from this paper, but I didn't want to get into models at this point, which show that makes sense if you start thinking about how, as a slab is sinking, it has to move flow around the edges of the slab. Okay, when that's a small slab, that flow that comes around the edges can really deform the slab, right? Whereas it's really long, it doesn't have the same effect. Now, trench motion isn't very important in terms of understanding what we see in the shape of slabs, because it is both controlled by the deformation, but also plate motions at the surface might end up controlling trench motion and affect how the slab is sinking. Okay, so trench motion can be a little bit tricky. First, let's define it. Here's a subducting plate in the slab, and here's the trench. If this location where the subducting plate is bending and sinking into the mantle is moving towards the subducting plate in time, then we say that the trench is retreating. Okay, if that point is moving towards the overriding plate, we say it's advancing. Okay, and some trenches could be stationary, right, non-moving. Yeah. That's what I just said. Depends on the reference frame. Absolutely.
So the question is, how do you adopt the reference frame to make
that? Well, we don't know. But Scheller has written, Scheller and co-authors wrote a very nice, well, very interesting paper looking at a bunch of different reference frames and trying to ask if there's some sort of physical condition in which could guide us in that choice. And they basically adopted an assumption of that. But the plate tectonic system would want to minimize viscous dissipation. That's one assumption, right? And if you use that assumption, you can basically then say, okay, what reference frame gives us actually a system which minimizes viscous dissipation? And numerical models suggest that when you have rollback, that is a case in which you have minimum of viscous dissipation, because instead of bending the slab, you allow the geometry you allow the slab to flatten and have a more gradual bending moment. And if that's so, then what you look for is a reference frame that maximizes trench rollback. Okay, it turns out that if you look at a whole range of reference frames, most of them, they have some slabs that are extremely different, but most of the slabs behave the same, right? So the reference frames are not so hugely different that the trench motion as a whole ends up being super, super different.
If I could just add to that, I think that is true on average.
On average.
But if you look at the regional patterns, then there are certain reference frames that could be argued to have a more physically plausible pattern of trench advance and trench retreat.
Yeah.
And we have argued there are such reference frames that exist. Yeah. And I think your point as to the viscous dissipation minimization is well taken, but
as
you and I know, we've both written papers on this. It's kind of subtle and depends on the mantle rheology, how you partition between, the
non-Newtonian rheology and bending of the slab.
For example,
absolutely.
And so this partitioning between rollback and bending is finicky, and even though there's been a bunch of papers on it, I don't think...
We have not answered, you don't know that is the assumption to make, to adopt,
Just my point being, one can look at other ways of defining absolute reference frames, and then look what the trenches do, or one can do it the other way around.
Yeah, very good.
I was just going to say that it's not clear that there's one single reference frame that explains everything, because there will be mantle wind, basically, so more or less regional mantle flow in different directions in different places of the Earth. So it's not clear that just by looking at the slabs, we can come up with a unique reference frame.
I don't think you could do it from just looking at the slabs. This was Scheller did one approach, right? But I think what Thorsten is saying is that there are other constraints, other observations, other ways of approaching the problem to figure out what an appropriate reference frame might be. Okay. All right. So just taking, I'm going to go forward with this reference frame. Okay. And I didn't write which one it was so that we wouldn't argue about it. People have very strong opinions about their reference frames. You can read Scheller's paper. But in this particular reference frame, which is these are actually the points that he basically says, this generally applies to all of the reference frames that we would find are appropriate, okay? And he does exclude some of them. And that is that the median trench motion is only about a centimeter per year, Okay? Most trenches are not racing forwards or backwards. Okay? The one sigma is at the level of plus or minus 2.5 centimeters. Okay? So that most trenches are only moving forward or backwards about 1 or 2 centimeters per year. Okay? They're not moving 10 centimeters per year. But some of them are. Okay? And the axis at the bottom here is distance to the closest slab edge. And you see that as you go closer to the slab edge, you end up getting higher velocities. And some places are really fast. Here's Tonga, okay, 16 centimeters per year. But it's anomalous, right? It's not the norm, okay? And like I said before, the 3D flow around the slab is a very good way of thinking about why are they faster, why is trench motion faster at the edges? It's because you don't just have the flow coming in, the displacement of the flow behind the slab, but you also have a component of flow from the sides. And that can help, that basically increases the stress on the slab, allows it to move more. These trench motions can change in time, and they may change pretty rapidly. Okay, this is just a paper by Simons et al. Showing two different snapshots of the world, one at 55 million years old and one at 65. This is just to illustrate in their model, with their reference frame, right, the kinds of changes that they have. So here's, for example, the Japan system at 55, which is advancing. That's what red is, advancing trench motion. And you see lots of other places that are retreating. Okay? But 10 million years later in Japan, the trench is rolling back. Okay, and if you, so in here, these are 10 million year snapshots. So clearly, you can have these changes in less than 10 million years. But it could be even shorter than that, right? Slab breakoff is a process that might occur in 2 to 5 billion years, based on models. And as we learned before, in the system of the fluid dynamical system for the Earth, these changes in driving forces or any forces are felt instantaneously across the system. Right? So you lose a slab over here, and the plate over here knows about it. Okay? So these, you can have events which can lead to changes in plate motion pretty rapidly. Thorsten.
Just a comment on the trench motions in the plate reconstructions, coming back to the reference frames.
Yeah.
I think your point is very well taken. These reorganization may be very rapid, but one should be very careful when looking at plate reconstructions and taking any of the kinematics at face value. In particular, the absolute reference frames in some of these reconstructions are what is, I think, technically called crazy. And you do have certain relative plate motions that are very well constrained and others that are very poorly constrained. And I think people making these plate reconstructions would agree with that, mm-hmm. and are aware of the issues. But anything that's out there right now, mm-hmm. really have to be very careful, because there are some huge fluctuations that might be due to two-polar wonder, or might be just because it's completely unconstrained and someone just moved the plate around.
Yeah. And maybe one way forward with that is actually we need to sort of use the dynamical models to figure out what can happen with plate motions, right? And sort of feed that back into the loop of creating reconstructions. All right. Yeah, Carolina?
Thorsten's point and your point, not so much for you guys, obviously, but for the audience. The problem, like Thorsten said, the plate reconstructions have errors, and all the people that do tectonic reconstructions know. And some of the choices are made up, right?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have the oceans, and therefore you put a big transform fault or a big subduction zone, and there's very little evidence except some geology in some continental area. And they know that. The problem is that I think in geodynamics, people tend to take something at face value, right? Mm-hmm. Here's a set of reconstructions, and this is going to become the canonical set of reconstructions, right? A, and B, they do the same for tomographic models. This is the canonical one, and we're going to use this to do all this stuff. And then people interpret it as if it's,
You forget that at the beginning you made a choice about what it was you were making, and that it's only one of a family of choices that you could make, right? Yeah, so don't be skeptical, I guess, of the fact that anything that uses a plate reconstruction or tomography, both of those things are models. They are not observations. Okay. All right, so if we move deeper down into the mantle. Max.
Add to this bit about plate reconstructions. Okay. I would also say that in particular, the oceanic plate motions are essentially manufactured.
In the past.
In the distant
plate
past.
Yeah. Beyond 280 million years ago.
And that unlike tomographic models, where we're given things like resolution matrices and estimates of uncertainty, there's no such product for plate reconstruction. So the honest thing to do would be to put in absolutely no information whatsoever. Sorry, I shouldn't be that strong.
That would be much less
fun. But very, very little information and almost 100% uncertainty about the oceanic plate motions.
Okay. All right. What do we know about slabs in the lower mantle? Okay. I put up the same picture. I could have chosen lots of other different pictures, but this is just to get basic observations home, okay? So this is not my favorite seismic tomography model. I don't have a favorite. It's just one that has really nice picture of slices of slabs, okay? So what do we see, what do we notice about when we look at slabs in seismic tomography models, okay? And as we know, it's a function of the model, the resolution, the data, everything that goes into those models. But in general, notice that slabs appear broader in the lower mantle than they do in the upper mantle, okay? And in some cases, they're really broad, okay? If you start out with a 100-kilometer thick slab and you image something that's 400 kilometers wide in the lower mantle, that is not just due to thickening, okay? It's not due to cooling, okay? You probably have to fold and buckle and really fold and buckle the slab in order to get something that wide, okay? We also notice that in some places, these slabs may actually go all the way to the core mantle boundary. Okay, this may not be agreed upon for this slice anymore, I don't know. But clearly in other places, they seem to bottom out somewhere in the mid-mantle. Okay, why that is, I'm not going to answer today. All right, there is a whole bunch of debate on the things that are going on in the middle of the mantle that might affect this. But what I'm going to talk about is what are the processes that could lead to that. Okay, the physical processes. And then you can figure out what the cause of those things are from mineral physics or other observations. Esteban.
So the fact that they're getting thicker, could that be just resolution of the tomography?
It also could, but I think that we've gotten to the point now where people have tested that for certain models and they get to the point where they say, no, right? I mean, there's some error, right, but their slabs are thicker in the lower mantle. That is my understanding. Maybe somebody who does this for a living could comment.
I was going to make a somewhat related comment, which is that for the students in the audience, it's important to realize that the bottom of these figures is not the core mantle boundary, which can be very misleading. It's crazy.
1,000 is the middle. That's 900 kilometers.
I think it's like 1,800.
Maybe 2,000, yeah.
And so this Mid-America one.
Maybe doesn't go all the way down. I have another one.
Yeah, sometimes they look like they go down, and certainly when we look at the base of the mantle, we have fast anomalies where we have seen past subduction. So that makes sense. Yeah. But it does seem like we kind of lose them along the way. And this Mid-America section is barely precisely chosen to show such kind of clear penetration. If you kind of slice it at a slightly different location, it looks a little different.
Okay. All right. But there are blue things at the core mantle boundary. So something blue is getting down there. Okay. It's sad. Okay. All right. Thank you for pointing out that the bottom is not at the core mantle boundary. It saves space in the diagram. Yeah. Okay. All right. So here's one that does go to the core mantle boundary. Two of them. Okay. So the last point I wanted to make about the observations, of course, is that slabs are not alone in the lower mantle. And this is important because most people who model subduction, right, not global mantle convection, but people who model subduction, tend to have an empty lower mantle in their models, okay? And I'll show examples of where we don't. Today I will talk about examples in which people have put things in the bottom and how important those are, okay? But when people like me are trying to understand how does the slab bend and deform in the upper mantle and how does that change plate motions, I usually just don't worry about what the LLSVPs are doing, right? Okay? But we may find that it's actually, especially if you're interested in what happens to the slab as it goes into the mid-mantle, you have to start worrying about what's in that mantle, Okay, and so here you can see this is the Tonga subduction zone. This is also a strangely oriented slice across Tonga, right? It's parallel to the Tonga slab, not perpendicular to it. But it does show that at this point where the slab is at the mid-mantle, there's something red coming up underneath it. It's very interesting. And actually that the Pacific superswell is there's this red thing that comes up to quite shallow depths behind the slab. Okay, and this, if that has buoyancy, if it's driving flow, it's going to have consequences for how the slab sinks into the mantle. Okay, and this is another example from the Simmons, this is gypsum, and this is another slab. This is actually in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And here's the African LLSVP, okay, and other red things, right? This looks like it may actually come all the way down to the coromantle boundary here. I don't know if that's attached to this, but there's blue things all the way at the coromantle boundary. Okay, all right, so now I'm going to shift into slab sinking and the dynamics, okay, some of the basics that we want to think about. So how do slabs sink in the upper mantle? So the first thing is that they have a density anomaly which is driving the flow. This is the gravitational driving force comes, which is allowing the slabs to sink. And the density anomaly is controlled by temperature, composition, phase changes, and thermal expansivity. This is important because thermal expansivity tells you actually how a temperature anomaly translates into a density anomaly, and it's not constant with depth or temperature. Okay. The slab is sinking into a mantle. The mantle is viscous and resists that sinking motion, and that is probably one of the primary resistance, okay, as the slab sinks into the mantle. But it's also the slab has some strength, some stiffness, and the sinking has to pull that slab behind it. It has to deform that slab, in particular as it bends, right, and enters the subduction zone. Okay, so as the slab bends, you have to energy is dissipated. Where does that energy come from? It comes from the buoyancy anomaly of the slab. Okay. In addition, in order for the subducting plate to move past the overriding plate, some sort of shear zone has to develop. It's a frictional shear zone at the surface. It may become some sort of viscous shear, you know, zone, really a shear zone at depth. But this is also a place where a lot of energy has to get dissipated, right? You have to pull the slab past the overriding plate, and that also helps to slow the slab down, okay? So you have one driving force, basically the density anomaly, which comes from a couple of different sources. And then you have these three different resisting forces. And this is important. This is the point that Thorsten made earlier, is that if you make one assumption about your rheology in the mantle, I'm going to assume it's temperature-dependent Newtonian, okay, that is going to impact, right, what kind of rheology you need in the plate in order to get the plate to subduct at a rate that is consistent with what we observe. You might need actually a weaker plate if you have Newtonian rheology. If I have non-Newtonian rheology, I'll tend to weaken the mantle around the slab because I have a high stress there. Okay. And if I weaken the mantle around the slab, well, more of this density of the slab has to be supported by the strength of the slab itself. So again, if I need to match the rate of subduction, I'm going to need a stronger slab. Okay. So these things trade off. And that's important when you're interpreting, right? The dynamics might not actually be that different between a Newtonian model with a lower plasticity slab and a non-Newtonian model with a higher plasticity slab. But the reason they're doing what they're doing and they have the rate they have is different, okay? So that's an important point when you're looking at models with different rheology. Okay, so how fast do slabs sink, okay? So we can start looking at that answer by looking at a Stokes sphere. So this has a density anomaly and a buoyancy force, which is related to the volume of the sphere, the density anomaly, and gravity. Okay. There are viscous forces, which are opposing the sinking motion of a sphere through a viscous medium. And I won't go in, this is basically based on geometry, and it's important, it's proportional to the viscosity of the surrounding mantle. This is a rigid sphere, and the velocity at which it's sinking. If you set these two forces to get equal, you can solve for the sinking velocity. Okay, and so it depends on the radius, the density anomaly, and inversely on the viscosity. Okay, so we can use this to estimate the sinking rate of a slab by choosing an appropriate radius, I chose 50 kilometers because that's half the width of the slab. And then the density anomaly is going to depend on what the temperature difference is between the sort of average temperature of the slab and the surrounding mantle. And then you need to choose a thermal expansion coefficient to change that into a density anomaly. And I will show an example of how thermal expansion changes with depth. It's about 3 or so in the upper mantle, but at the core mantle boundary, it's only 1. Okay? So if I use 3 for a temperature anomaly of 400 Kelvin, I get a density anomaly of 68, so 68 to 100. But if I had a thermal expansion of 1, the density anomaly would be a third. Okay? So one of the first things you can think about is you think about slabs going into the lower mantle. They may be warming up, okay, but they don't lose that mass. They just get wider. Okay? So the total density anomaly just gets sort of spread out. So your total mass is conserved, right? But because the thermal expansion coefficient is changing, that effective temperature anomaly doesn't really map into the same density anomaly. Okay? And if you actually take into account compressibility effects, it may not be as big of a difference. I cannot comment on that. I haven't done compressible models. But this is just an idea to get to realize that as you go down, temperature anomaly doesn't map the same into density anomaly with depth. Okay, even just for this one parameter. So if we look at how this depends on the viscosity, all right, here's my sphere with a 50 kilometer radius, and I look at for the upper mantle range of viscosities from 10 to the 19 to 10 to the 21. And notice this is a log scale of sinking velocity in centimeters per year. So at 10 to the 20, I get a sinking velocity of about 10 centimeters per year. Okay, and it just is proportional to 1 over the viscosity. So if you change the viscosity by an order of magnitude, you change the rate by an order of magnitude. Okay. To get a sense of what those numbers mean, this is what I always do. 5 centimeters per year, that's 50 millimeters per year. It's 50 kilometers per million years. So in 10 million years, I would go 500 kilometers. So that's a really good number to have in your head because it means slabs only take 10 million years to get through the upper mantle. Okay, maybe faster, maybe slower, but about 10 million years. Okay, they spend a lot longer in the lower mantle. Okay, and we have one other weird thing. We think the asthenosphere viscosity is probably somewhere over here, but slabs don't go 100 centimeters per year. I promise. All right, so why not? Anybody? I already told you the answer. Yeah, they're not sinking by themselves. They're attached to a slab that has to be pulled, and you have to put energy, right? So if you're not putting the energy into moving the mantle, maybe you're not, that energy, right, can actually be dissipated in the slab, okay? So really you have to, this gives you a starting point, but you have to remember it's a slab, it's not a Stokes sphere, okay? It is attached. And there's another way to slow down the slab. That is that when the slab actually gets to the lower mantle, the viscosity is higher, okay? And this, if you have a slab that has any kind of stiffness to it, it will slow down, right? And actually, it's very obvious in models. When you watch the velocities, the velocity of the slab increases, and then it reaches the lower, it starts to interact with the lower mantle, and it slows down, okay? So as slabs enter the transition zone, they tend to slow down because they start to interact with the higher viscosity lower mantle. But there's a bunch of other buoyancy forces that come into play, right? So you have phase transitions that are occurring at the 410, in between, this is like the 520, and then at the upper mantle, lower mantle boundary. The phase transitions above have a positive Clapeyron slope, so that means that the phase transition happens at a shallower depth, and this creates a density anomaly which increases the density. Okay, so my slab actually becomes a little bit denser here because of the phase transition. It happens shallower. Same thing here, but at 660 you have a negative Clapeyron slope, and so the transition is delayed, and so you actually have more buoyant material in the middle of the slab, and that helps to resist. Okay, and so you're changing that driving force through these phase transitions. Okay. So what happens to the slab when it comes into contact with the lower mantle? In the upper mantle, you have less resistance to sinking. You have a somewhat stiff slab, okay? And now you're being slowed down from below, right? So there's a couple, there's basically three options, I think. So the slab can pivot forward, right? Basically, it's sinking faster here. It has some resistance here. It could basically fold forward, right? Just sort of pivot forward and change its shape. This would tend to give you overturned slabs, right? We don't really see largely overturned slabs in most tomography models, okay? The other option is that it rolls backwards, right? Pivots backwards. And this seems to be an important factor in how you might create flat slabs in the transition zone, right? The slab, upon meeting this resistance at the 660, has to change its geometry to accommodate the different sinking rates, and it does so by basically pivoting backwards and laying flat on the transition zone. The other option is that it buckles, folds, okay? And I'll show some models which show how this happens. And this is ultimately going to be controlled by the rheology, but also what else is happening in the mantle around the slab, okay? So in these three different cases, slab rheology is going to be important. A higher viscosity slab can transmit stresses up dip, right? It may basically force the slab to slow down and reconfigure itself, okay? Lower viscosity slab might be able to just sort of bend and fold, right, in order to accommodate these changes. And yielding can actually lead to sort of localized folding, which really buckles the slab, okay? It also depends on the mobility of the surface plates, right? The slab wants to do one thing, but if those plates at the surface are being pulled in other directions, and that also sets up a flow around the slab, what happens to the slab depends on those other viscous stresses and the ability to actually move the plates at the surface, right? So not every slab is going to deform the same because the other conditions are not the same. Okay. And then finally, the flow geometry is important, right? So a narrow slab might be able to change its dip in a different way than a much larger, longer slab, okay? I think that's the main thing I wanted to say about that. All right, so to get a little bit of an idea about why the mantle flow around the slab is important, this is an example of something called a corner flow, okay? And in corner flow, you have a subducting plate and a rigid slab and an overriding plate, and you basically push the slab into the mantle at a constant velocity. And when you do that, it induces a flow in the mantle, which entrains the mantle into the flow around the slab. Okay? Now what's important is when you entrain this flow, right, if you remember the conservation of momentum equation, you have buoyancy force and you have the sort of strain range stress, but you also have pressure, right? So not only do you cause flow, but you also change the pressure field. And in a corner flow above around a slab, what you do is you create a region of low pressure above the slab, right? So where you have low pressure, things flow in. Underneath it, you create a high pressure under here. So flow, things are being pushed out. And you end up overall with this pressure gradient across the slab, which is acting to actually lift the slab, okay? How important this is depends on the viscosity, okay? It's proportional to viscosity. But it, really what I want to use this for is an example of how the geometry and the flow actually imposes pressure, which is basically stress, on the slab itself, okay? So you can't just think slab just sinks in, okay? If there's a viscous boundary, right, as you go into the lower mantle, that forces a certain geometry, and that changes the pressure field, and the slab has to respond to that pressure field, okay? So one example of this, I have to go quickly. This is a model by Jagutz, Royden, Holt, and Becker. And they were interested in looking at why did the Indian plate accelerate between 80, 40 million years as the Indian plate was moving towards Eurasia. And based on geologic evidence, they proposed that there was actually a second subduction zone between India and Eurasia. And at a certain point, this went from being a very long set of a double subduction zone to being a narrow subduction zone. And what happened when it narrowed, right, is that you went from a time in which these two slabs were basically acting independently, right? They didn't really notice each other's pressure field, okay? But once you shortened it, this actually created a very strong pressure difference around the two slabs, and it basically allowed the flow from this slab to affect the flow from the other slab. So this slab here ended up going faster and sinking faster because the pressure effect from the slab in front of it. Okay? So this shows sort of how geometry and the can basically affect the rate of motion, right, through sort of pressure differences that are set up by that geometry. Okay. So, question? Where am I?
Ah. Can you go back to the previous slide, please?
I'm trying.
Okay. I don't understand this gray zone.
This?
Yeah.
So this is a picture taken from a News and Views, right, which was basically describing how what you end up with is sort of like a pipe flow in the middle, which the flow is being directed laterally between the slabs.
Yeah, but so what creates this sort of...
It's basically being created by the sinking motion of these two individual slabs, right? And so that ends up creating basically a pressure which drives the flow out the sides.
But aren't you missing material somewhere?
No, it has the flow has to be conserved, basically, by...
I still don't understand where the material is coming from.
It's being squeezed out, basically, between the two slabs. Yeah.
Okay.
The trench is shorter. The trench is shorter.
The trench is shorter,
that's right. The trench is shorter. So you can. Okay. Too far through that. Okay, so this is, I just wanted to show one or two simulations where I could talk through some of these, although I have to go quickly. So this is a model without any phase changes. It has a jump in viscosity. There's nonlinear rheology in the upper mantle. The slab can deform by some level of plasticity. But I think what I want to point out with this, it's going really slow, is that notice it's near vertical in the beginning. And this curvature backwards, part of it's developed up here, but actually it forms because the flow, as the slab tip gets here, actually is directed backwards. It actually pulls the tip backwards at this point. Okay, and it's because there's actually a very strong return flow at the beginning underneath the slab. Right, that the flow really wants to wrap around in this little pocket. Okay, that may be due to the 2D nature, the choice of rheology, but it's just an illustration of this effect. Okay, this is I didn't used to have these things go so slow. Here we go. This is the same exact model, except now there's phase transitions. Okay. And you get a very different behavior of the slab with buckling and folding. Part of this is because you have latent heat release and shear heating in this model, but also because you have this distribution of extra forces above the 660 and then some additional resistance at the 660 from the phase transitions. So you get this buckling and folding behavior, even though it's a very sort of vertical slab at the beginning. And notice that it's sinking fairly slowly. You get these folds, right, that then sink into the lower mantle. And this is a relatively low viscosity lower mantle. It's about 10 to the 22 or so. Okay? Yes?
So, Magali, what will be the surface expression of this behavior? Will we see the front of the arc moving?
Yeah, so in these models down here, what you see, this is actually the plate velocity down here. And if there's one, the green line is the trench location. And so the trench location moves back and forth at about a rate of 1 to 2 centimeters per year.
So that would that trigger subduction erosion versus accretion, for example?
It could, yeah. In all of these models, we end up with substantial accretion of material from the
accretion more
plate,
than subduction
but that might
erosion.
Be numerical. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Okay. David?
Is this at all affected by the size of the box you're modeling? And are you modeling outside of the box that is being shown?
Yeah, this is a model that goes to the core mantle boundary, and it's about 7,000 kilometers across.
And width as well?
It's a 2D model. So yeah. So yes, it will depend on the size of the box. It depends also whether it's 2D or 3D.
Also to note that the kinematics aren't the only things we might observe at the surface, but there's also other stress-related quantities like the dynamic topography, as many here in the room, like Carlina and Magali have worked on. And so I think it's been explored quite a bit for plumes, what happens when a plume interacts with a phase transition coming up. But the overriding plate topography here is interesting, and it will respond to the folding mainly of the slab, and that's to do also with the phase transition.
Yeah.
So there's a
In these models, there's no way I could have gone into that. These are models I did with SICOM. They were really expensive to run, even in 2D, because of the nonlinearity. But it would be very interesting to I would need to have some sort of sticky layer of free surface
to do
that.
I don't think you do.
It's a free slip surface, so I can't look at dynamic topography.
I think that's true.
What?
I think you could.
Do it in SICOM?
Yeah. I mean, not exactly at the trench, on the short wavelength stuff.
But the longer wavelength, sure.
Yeah, sort of where
just
you would...
Just in terms of the stresses.
Where you would have basins recording the ups and downs, a little bit away from the trench.
I would have to do more... I would have to do a better job of modeling the rheology of the overriding plate. Depends on what scale you want to look at it. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it.
I have a further question.
Yeah.
Probably simply reflecting my ignorance, but... And that's for you, all of you. What's the difference in strength of a sinking slab versus a plume? And the difference in resistance you think you would face at the phase transitions. I have a hard time actually understanding the difference in density of the subducting slab versus the mantle.
So the density anomaly of the slab is on the order of 50 kilograms per meter cubed. Does somebody have a plume number in their head? What's the density anomaly from a plume? Less. Okay. So plumes will have less buoyancy, right, than the slabs have going down, right, in sort of the opposite direction. Right. All right. So how is slab behavior different in the lower mantle? The questions we want to ask is how does the buoyancy of the slab change as it goes into the lower mantle, and then also how does the viscosity change? Because those are basically the two things that are controlling how the slab deforms and how it sinks into the mantle. All right, so this is a picture that it comes from the same paper that Max showed. This is a paper by Michael Manga that looked at the shearing of a blob in a very simple, this is the flow that's imposed with a 10 centimeter per year at the surface. Okay, it's just going around. And this is the initial position of a blob that is 10 times more viscous than the mantle. And you can see how the blob sort of deforms as it goes around. Okay, and by the time it gets back to its starting position, it's a little bit more elliptical than it was initially. And if I put in 10 centimeters per year, this whole rotation around is about 500 million years. Okay, so even with in this shear flow, with just a factor of 10 more viscous slab, you get the slab stays really slab-like. Okay, the same is not true if it's something that's weaker. Okay, if you have a times 10 decrease in viscosity for your plume. All right, that gets highly sheared and deformed by the stronger viscosity around it, right? It becomes the thing that can move and be sheared by the stresses in the flow, okay? And if you have, no viscosity difference, you get something like this, okay? So we can debate how strong are slabs in the lower mantle, but a factor of 10 is not a lot in viscosity, and it allows slabs to stay relatively coherent, okay, as they go into the mantle. Okay, that's why I said stirring. We're good at the stirring level. Okay, I'm not mixing anything yet. I'm not mixing anything until I start getting here. Okay, and so the other thing that changes is just the absolute viscosity in the lower mantle. And so instead of looking at a range of 19 to 21, we now need to look at viscosities that are probably 10 to the 22, 10 to the 23 in the lower mantle. Okay, so if we look again at our Stokes sphere, right, we're predicting rates that are sinking rates that are on the order of 0.1 centimeters per year, millimeter per year, less than a millimeter per year. Okay? So it would take, at 0.1 centimeters per year, it takes 10 million years to go 10 kilometers. All right? And this is an important number to think about in terms of why we see slabs kind of in the upper mantle, right, that are very visible, and they all look like they're stuck there, right? Are they stuck there, or are they just moving really slowly, okay? And the other thing is, and I'll show this in a minute, is that the slab is going to start slowing down before it actually gets to the really viscous material, okay? It will start the slowdown process, right? If you had a jump, it slows down before it actually gets there. If you have a gradient, right, the fact that the viscosity is lower, it prevents the flow from going down in front of the sinking slab, and it gets deflected, right? So even if you aren't to the point where you're like at 10 to the 23 and your slab is still here, it's going to already slow down more because the flow in front of it has to turn sideways. Okay? Yeah.
There are these reconstruction, or, well, these attempts by, well, there's a group in the Netherlands, I guess, and another group in Norway trying to estimate the sinking speeds of slabs, and they come up with numbers more around 1 centimeter per year.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if the, first, I'm not sure if the lower mantle is
that viscous.
10 to the 23 everywhere.
No, right.
Maybe it only might locally.
It might be deeper, right?
Yeah.
And where, but that's kind of the point. Like, so if you get a centimeter per year in the upper 1,000, down to 1,000 or 1,500 kilometers, right? That part is probably less than 10 to the 23, right? Because it's hard for it to sink faster than, I mean, because, you know, our slabs are bigger, but they're, so that helps a little bit, but their density anomaly, you know, your total mass is what it is, right? Student, and then Thorsten.
Just as a point of clarification, maybe you mentioned this and I missed it, is what makes the slabs more viscous? Is it intrinsic, or is it just temperature?
No, it's the temperature dependence of viscosity. Thank you for asking that question. Yes. So there can be some intrinsic effects, okay? If the slab is made up of crust and Hartzbergite and then regular lithosphere, the Hartzbergitic layer is the residual of melting at the subduction zone, at the mid-ocean ridge. It's probably drier, okay? But that gives you maybe a factor of 3 or so, maybe a factor of 10 at the most, but not really. The real control is temperature. And one question you might ask is, do we expect the same temperature, very strong temperature dependence for lower mantle minerals as we get for olivine? Olivine is very strongly temperature dependent viscosity, right? I think we expect ridgmanite to be the same, but then we would actually, you know, there must be low temperature effects in terms of controlling the viscosity of the slab, even in the lower mantle, because otherwise temperature effects alone, you'd predict 10 to the 24 viscosity for the slab. Is it 10 to the 24? Then it should be this really strong, stiff thing in the lower mantle. And I'll actually show some models of sinking in a second.
Can I just have a quick comment on that? It looks like a maximum raise a different point. They infer, topographically infer the sinking rate of the slab is like one order of magnitude faster than this.
I'll show you why in a second, actually.
Oh, you can talk about it.
Yeah, this is a 50 kilometer radius slab, right? So it's a little chunk of slab, okay? But slabs don't just go in little chunklets, right? Sorry, well, I'll show you in a second. Okay, it's actually a couple slides, but there's an example where I show what the sinking rate is. And maybe one way of thinking about it is if you start folding it and piling it on top of each other, now I have a 400 kilometer wide slab, and it's a pile of slab. Right? Then it will sink faster. Okay, so here's just an example of effects of increasing mantle viscosity. These are done with a viscosity change at 660, but you could just move this down if you were interested, like what would happen at 1,000 kilometers, okay? And so this is the viscosity scale here. So here the lower mantle is at 10 to the 21, and the upper mantle here is at 10 to the 19. And then if you just increase the transition zone viscosity, you start to get a little bit of folding. And here, this is actually, the color scale is not very easy to see here, but this is actually increasing it to about 10 to the 22. And then here you have 10 to the 23, okay? And so this slab is sinking very easily through this upper portion, but just the viscosity gradient, right, and jump here ends up stopping the slab. And if you, you know, in your mind, you can take these and just move it down, right? What if it was at 1,000 kilometers, okay? So gradients in viscosity will do this pretty much just as well as a jump in viscosity. Okay? It takes a longer, but it's pretty much the same, okay? This is an example related to the point about thermal expansion coefficient, okay? This is an old paper. Oh, I forgot to write this down. This is by King and Ida, okay? And what they did is they took a model, it's a cylindrical model with kinematic boundary conditions, and the slab subducts into the, no, I think it has a protoslab. It has a protoslab. And then the slab buoyancy sinks, pulls the slab into the mantle, it goes flat at the 660, and then eventually it sinks into the lower mantle, okay? Now, the actual behavior, right, and the length of each of these stages depends on the assumption for the thermal expansion coefficient. Okay, so this is the thermal expansivity. They did a model with a constant value, a model that was just depth dependent, right? So going from about 2 to 1 with depth. And then these black curves are showing the temperature dependence for a model which for pyrolite. And then the dashed lines are making a different assumption about how the expansivity changes when you go into lower mantle. Okay? And what they find is that this really affects how long you have slabs trapped at the 660 and when they might fall through, okay? And the reason, so here, the constant model, you actually get a slab that is flat for a while and then it sinks through. The depth dependence, you actually, the slab just is stuck for more than 180 million years at the transition zone. But if you take into account the mineralogy, which, if you go back, has this little increase in the expansion coefficient right underneath the 660, then that helps the slab to get through the 660 more quickly, right? It has a very short period of time where it's just sitting here, okay? So these sorts of parameters end up, you know, we think about phase transitions, we think about viscosity, but we also have to think about how we map from temperature to density anomaly, okay? All right, I already said that. All right.
I have a quick question. So if a slab spends only a little bit of its time at the 660, then wouldn't that imply that if we just look around the world that we shouldn't see most slabs?
So I said less time. It's still not short.
Okay.
Right. It's these are in these particular models with these parameters, right? This is still some of these are 30 million years.
Okay.
Right? This one's a little bit shorter. That's about 20 million years.
Okay, and then of course, if you have like slab trench rollback, you would have much more.
Perhaps, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So this one actually has trench rollback, which is part of why it goes flat, right? Yeah. Okay. So a quick summary of the first two parts. I kind of almost on time, not quite, but we'll see. All right. So we have a couple of things to keep in mind. We have many more observations and different kinds of observations in the upper mantle for slabs. The slabs look different in the upper mantle versus the lower mantle, and that's a result of the difference in the driving forces that are available, the viscosity structure, and also the fact that there's something coming up from underneath, okay? And the three main things to think about in terms of what controls the dynamics of the slab is its buoyancy, the viscosity contrast between the slab and the surrounding mantle, and then how viscosity is increasing with depth. All right, so now let's turn to these examples. What is the fate of slabs as they go down? I've tried to choose a range of examples, and some of them are actually quite simple in terms of their setup. And for the students, I think these are good examples to think about in terms of what can you set up to test an idea that is very simple but captures the essentials of the problem that you're going after. Okay, and there's a couple different examples of where you'll see that. Okay, so the first slide, I have a question. Okay, here's the result of a numerical simulation where I have a slab, flat slab, and I want to ask which symbol marks the initial location of the trench. Okay, does it start at the circle, the diamond, or the triangle? Okay, how many people say circle? This is 660-ish. Doesn't really matter, actually. Right. No, it's dynamical. It's totally dynamical. Right? So it says this is viscosity, so you have a strong viscosity, it's Newtonian. This is like I'm learning how to use aspect. Okay? This is me playing with aspect. Okay? And you can do this with the built-in stuff in aspect, right? I could give you my PRM file, you could run it. All right, so where does it start? How many people say circle? How many people say diamond? How many people say triangle? Okay, so I expected a split between diamond and triangle, which is good, all right? It starts in the middle. Okay, so what does that mean, right? It means that this has to move sideways, okay? So here is actually what inspired me to show you that. And this is a tomography model from the Japan's lab. This is one slice of a pretty detailed model. And this is what's called the flat Pacific slab. Here's Japan in the very shallow dipping slab with seismicity, okay? And here's the Japan Sea, which is a back arc basin that opened up between 20 and 10 million years ago, okay? Down here is the age of the plate, okay, at the time it's the time at which the plate subducted, okay? So 10 million years means that this part of the slab was at the trench 10 million years ago. So there's a problem. This part that was here 10 million years ago, right, well, that Japan Sea back arc spreading was already over, okay? So this is not a result of back arc, of rollback. Okay, related with Japan Sea, but this part is. But this part is not under the Japan Sea, right? It's been laterally transported. And that's what this paper by Liu et al. And EPSL concluded, right, is that you had to have about 6 to 7 centimeters per year of slab advance within the transition zone. Okay, so let me show you actually the movie of my little test model. And so you can see that it actually slides sideways. Okay. By the way, this is a completely unrealistic viscosity structure down here. Okay. It's because we have to modify aspects material model. But the reason this goes so flat right here is because the flow can't go vertically down into this higher viscosity mantle. And so as the slab comes down, the flow directs sideways. And so this thing just starts sort of translating sideways. You get a period of rollback while this is actually moving backwards. So roll back, this moves sideways, and then this stops during this whole last portion. They're far away, and it's 5,000 kilometers down to the core mantle boundary. Yeah. But it's a really, really strong lower mantle, okay? No. Yeah.
So the... How long is this stagnant slab? I remember the tomography had like thousands of kilometers, more than 1,000.
It's about 1,000. How long is the flat slab in Japan?
In the tomography, it's very long.
It's very long, yeah.
It's very long.
Yeah. This is...
It's more than 10 degrees.
Yeah, like this 20. Is more than 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah, that's right. So in the model, how long...
I wasn't trying to model this.
Oh, okay.
Was just inspired by it as what the process is. Like, really, how do slabs move sideways? And actually, at CIDR last year, I thought, maybe you need flow from underneath, right, to actually pull this thing sideways. But it turns out that it might just move sideways because of the effects of the boundary condition in the transition zone where you have phase transition viscosity increase, right? The flow is deflected by that structure between the upper and the lower mantle, okay? And I'm not the only person that got this. After I looked at this, I was like, I can't be the only one. That was a play model, right? So actually, this is a paper by Agusta et al. And here, look, the black triangle marks the initial point of the slab, basically. Initial point of the trench. And notice that it also ends up in the middle of their flat slab. Okay, so they're seeing exactly the same thing. The slab is being translated sideways. Okay. All right, so slabs can be translated sideways at the transition zone. And not related to the surface motion necessarily in a one-to-one fashion, okay? So that makes it harder to just sort of take slab geometry and relate it to what was happening at the surface, okay? All right.
So Magali, also, it makes it very hard to take the tomography and interpret sinking rates and which trenches it's related to. And then, trying to infer viscosity from it, which is what the Van der Meer and the Oslo group are trying to do,
yeah.
where they interpret every single blue blob as
yeah. I actually have an example from one of those, right, where I think maybe it's a little bit more legitimate, but yes, it's very hard, right? You have to, I think you have to be doing a numerical model to test those hypotheses, right, and to see what would actually happen with the real structure. Okay, so here's another example model. This is looking at interaction of the slab with a plume upwelling here. So this is inspired by this slice where you have the superswell coming up underneath the Tonga slab. So here's a model without a plume, okay, which they basically, they have a plate which is subducting in, they're only showing the subducting plate. They have a little oceanic plateau which is resisting sinking. But this basically ends up lying flat at the 660. When they incorporate a plume, they not only get this cool sort of wraparound flow, right, but they also notice they lift the slab up over here, right? And this is the kind of geometry we actually see at the northern edge of the Tonga subduction zone, where the slab is being sort of curled and wrapped around itself on the northern side, okay? So, and notice that this is not a super complicated model in order to test this idea, right? I have a 3D slab, I have a plume coming up from the bottom, what happens? So let's move down to the core mantle boundary. And what happens if a slab actually makes it all the way down to the core mantle boundary? Okay. So we have heard some other discussion and suggestion about how slabs might help to sweep up piles and organize them or divide them over long periods of time. And there's been, I just wanted to show sort of a simple example of how the flow induced by the slab interacts with the thermal boundary layer, but also what happens when the slab actually ends up laying down on the core mantle boundary. So this is a simple model which starts out with a thermal boundary layer, right, and two thermal boundary layers, and one in which you develop a slab. And then after a while, you end up with perturbations on this boundary layer, and you start to create little plumes. And this one is very much affected by the fact that this thing is sinking and develops a flow, right, that has to come down and around this way and down and around this way, right? So you start to create, to help sort of the instability along this thermal boundary layer develop here, and you can see another one starting over here. Eventually, right, this plume ends up actually being kind of fixed at the toe of the slab because you end up with a strong temperature gradient which helps to kind of continue to pull the thermal boundary layer into that location. Okay, so this gives maybe some intuition for why you might have some coincidence between locations of slabs and plumes, maybe only small plumes, right? But there's an interaction between that cold, strong slab and then how the thermal boundary layer basically gets pulled up into those locations. Okay? Another example from the same paper, this is by Ertan, is what happens when a slab just lays down on top of this strong thermal boundary layer. Okay, this was pre-post-perovskite and all that stuff, okay? So this is just looking at, if you take a temperature anomaly of a certain thickness slab and you have a certain viscosity variation, and you let things heat up, okay? And two things happen. One is that you create a little slab at the tip, a plume at the tip of the slab, but notice you're also building up hot material under the slab that's trapped because you have this dense, slightly stiff slab sitting on top of it. Well, eventually you can build up enough buoyancy, right, and you start to heat up the slab so it weakens, that you can erupt a large plume head from underneath the slab, okay? So I don't have any evidence of these things happening in a particular place, but I think they're interesting, simple models that allow you to just look at the two things that I've talked about. What's the importance of buoyancy? What's the importance of viscosity in controlling the dynamics, okay? And they actually, you know, they have these diagrams which basically look at the initial sort of temperature or buoyancy of the slab, how the cold, thick layer versus a slightly warmer slab, how stiff it is, sort of the integrated viscosity of the slab. And then this is the size of the plume head, the buoyancy of the plume heads. You get really big plumes if you have a stiffer, colder slab, right? Because it takes longer, you can build up a big plume. And then also that takes longer, right? So those would be more unusual events in the Earth history if this is happening. Okay, Sujoy.
wondering if any of the results from these simple models change if you consider both thermal and compositional buoyancy?
Of course, yes. So if you put so this is why LLSVPs are stable, right? Because they actually end up being dense but sort of viscous things that sit down there, right? So they buoyant but viscous, so they can't rise. Yeah.
So then when we look at, for example, the Tan et al. Paper that you're showing as mm-hmm. a non-geodynamicist, how should I interpret these results or the applicability of these results?
Right. So well, the LLSVPs are not everywhere. Right, you may have areas of the core mantle boundary which are, you know, are free from that material, right? So you actually do have background mantle material. It would be post-perovskite, so you have to consider that and what its rheology is. But you could build on that, right? I mean, you could take this simple model and then say, let's put post-perovskite in there and see how it changes this result, right? It's a good suggestion. Okay. Right. Yeah.
I think Sujoy was at least partially asking about the compositional effects of the slab itself.
The composition of the slab.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess people have looked at effects. So there's the crust, right? The crust.
The crust may not be there anymore.
And if you have depletion, that will play a role for the rheology. Right. It will also play some role for the density effect. But I think the compositional effects within the slab are sort of the 20% kind of order.
Yeah.
So the purely thermal stuff is going to give you a good feeling, and then plus or minus some.
Yeah. I don't think I misunderstood. I don't think the composition of the slab is going to be the major effect. It's going to be the temperature difference. It'll modulate it, but
at least for the present day Earth, right? Yeah. I mean, of course, in the early Earth, when you have a really super thick crust, then it's been argued it might stop plate tectonics.
Maybe it won't, but it'll become more important,
something to worry about.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, you could set up this exact same model I could set it up in Aspect this afternoon with a compositional variation, the compositional density, and we could see what happened. Right.
Okay. I think Maxime has a paper on slab stagnating in the mid-mantle due to a compositional contrast, where, though I think there it's the mantle itself that changes, right, gradually becoming more enriched in basaltic component, which makes it denser. And so the slabs become neutrally buoyant in the mid-mantle.
Yeah. Okay. So the next example gets to one of these, the other question about sort of the sinking rate of slabs in the mid-mantle. And so this is a paper by Siskova et al. In which they looked at the consequences of having sort of a uniform viscosity with depth versus just having an increasing viscosity with depth in the lower mantle. And what they were looking at was this idea of where you have a slab that's relatively stationary, and so you actually are making sort of a folded pile at the top of the upper mantle, right? So this is a result of that sort of folding, bending motion, which I showed in the previous model. And then it breaks off, okay? And then sinks into the lower mantle. So notice, here is the time scale. This is with the uniform viscosity. This is at 60 million years. And this is at 120 million years. Right? So it's basically 60 million years just in the sort of upper half of the lowermost mantle. Right? And it takes about 180 million years to get to the lowest most mantle. Okay? And here, they actually have a viscosity increase. And then you can compare the times. 160, this is now 280. And then 400 million years later. Okay, there's nothing else going on in the lower mantle in these models. It's just a sinking experiment, right, at that point. But whether you have a gradient versus uniform will affect basically the rate at which it sinks into the lower mantle. But these rates are definitely faster than just my little Stokes sphere, right, because I have a big pile that I scrunched up together. So I have a sphere that's much bigger with a big density anomaly. Okay, so it can sink faster. Yeah, Yogo? And then to the back.
Why is slab breaking off?
I think that they purposely put in a weak region so that it would, right, so that it would then break off and they could look at the evolution just in the lower mantle, separate from what was going on in the upper mantle. Yeah. Did you have a question? Yeah.
Even though it's a bigger ball, aren't you in training sort of surrounding material and sort of diluting that cold slab?
So as it sinks, because it's viscous, it basically stays like its own little blob, and it is heating up, right? But heating up is also cooling down the surrounding mantle. So the total negative buoyancy is the same, it's just spread out over a larger area.
Stokes sphere is actually a three-dimensional feature, right?
Yeah.
It has resistance from all sides, all five sides. Mm-hmm. But in the 2D subduction, or the natural subduction system, it's more like a 2D, right? So it's, mm-hmm. you only have resistance from the left and right and the bottom probably, but not the in and out side.
Right, yeah. So you can do something you can calculate shape factors for like different shape ellipsoids instead of a sphere. You can even do pancake-shaped things.
And like a tabular feature.
Yeah, or tabular, right? And you will reduce it, but you'll reduce it sort of in both. So it does allow the slab to sink more, right? It has
a faster rate
exactly. if it's a slab than if it's a ball.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay. So this is an example of how you get that kind of folding and pile up of the slab. This is a younger slab than the other model that I showed you, and you can see that it folds more easily. You get tighter folds that are piled up more directly on top of each other. It also has slightly less buoyancy, although my mantle doesn't increase in viscosity with depth, so it pretty much just sinks directly down. Okay. I don't want to spend too much time on that movie. I just wanted it as an illustration of the folding event that gets you to the piles that then have to sink in by themselves.
It seems like there's this natural periodicity to the overriding plate velocity.
You would predict that there would be a periodicity to the surface plate motions, but again, remember, these are in isolation of the
True.
Rest of the mantle,
right,
which might have a mantle wind, which might impose some forward mm-hmm. or backwards motion. There's a 3D effect that has to be taken into account as well.
I was just wondering if it's ever been observed. Geologically.
Okay. There are places, I think Lijun actually, wrong person. There's a paper whose name I can't remember right now, that looked at periodicity of the surface plate motion in South America, which may be related to this. Okay, I'm going to move to the next example, which will be very controversial, I'm sure. So this is one of these models which is trying to basically do a geologic reconstruction of seismic tomography, relating it to surface motion, okay? And I think it's an interesting idea, and the question is how to pursue it in the context of what I've shown you about how complicated slab surface motions are. So this is by Siglock and Mihalinuk in Nature, and basically here's North America at about 140 million years ago, and what they propose based on the present-day seismic anomalies is that the bottom of a pile of seismic anomalies, which are now underneath North America, started out as subduction zones that were dipping, that were off the coast of North America, right? And dipping in basically away from North America here, towards it here, away from it here. And that these, so actually you had sort of westward dipping slabs, right? In parts of the coast of North America. And then over time, you continue to basically subduct material into different subduction zones off the coast of North America, while North America is basically moving towards the west and eventually overrides these thermal anomalies. So the coloring here is by depth in the present day. So now these anomalies are like at 1,400 kilometers. These are at 1,000. These are at 800 to 1,000. And what they're trying to do is basically say the material at this depth, where was it at the surface when it actually got subducted, okay? And trying to relate that to plate reconstructions. And so they do this basically for the whole pile of slabs, and they basically argue that you create these folded slab walls, right, which then sort of sink into the mantle. And so this structure that you see under North America, sorry, this stops at 55 million years. I didn't have time to do the whole sequence. But you have this sort of wall of material, right, which is now sitting over here because North America moved that way. And that this was formed during a time in which you had actually a relatively stable subduction zone in a single place that was folding backwards and forwards and created this pile which then sank into the lower mantle. Now, the one thing I would point out about their picture in terms of what this model showed, and these are from the movies that I showed you earlier, that the slabs fold at the transition zone. They fold at the location where you have the viscosity jump and the resistance from the phase transition. They don't fold above it. So I think this cartoon is should be modified, okay? The folding is formed at the 660, and then the pile would then sink down, okay? So this may be, right, a place where this process of slab folding and capturing the slow sinking of the slab is has happened in the past. And this may be happening in the present day in the Marianas. So the Marianas has a very steep subduction zone, but then you have this broad seismic anomaly underneath it, underneath the 660. And so this is a model by Foucault suggesting this is actually a folded slab, and this is just the viscosity structure that you would get. Okay, so these slab walls may be forming, and then piles, right, then sinking through the lower mantle, right, which don't give you any really information about what was happening in terms of surface motion. Okay, so the last example I have is interaction of subduction zones with the LLSVPs. Okay, and I show these are two pictures from the same seismic tomography model. And one of them shows the Farallon slab, which the last paper would say is not the Farallon slab, it's something else, at least down here. but there's also a similar-looking seismic anomaly. These have the same velocity scale, okay, sitting in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Okay, so this is Australia, Antarctica, and this profile is taken across here. All right, and this big slab, and notice the top of it is actually in the transition zone. Okay, is sitting basically right under here. Actually, it's right here. Okay? Have you ever heard of the slab in the Indian subduction zone? Right? A few people. Has there been a subduction zone sitting out here, dipping that way? Not that we know of. Okay? All right. So here's a simple idea. This paper just came out last week.
Sorry, before we continue.
You want to tell me it's not there?
No, okay. No. There's definitely, well, definitely. It's there's the high there. Form of, high pressure form of English, right? So there's potentially a fast anomaly exactly where Nathan sees it.
Yeah.
The only thing that I wanted to point out is that the exact geometry one infers
depends
really depends on what cross-section you take,
yes,
especially in this case.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But there is a blue thing in the uppermost mantle going to 660 in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and where we don't think there has been a subduction zone last 200 million
years. It's mostly in the lower mantle, isn't it?
Well, it starts at the 660. I mean, I guess it goes deeper when you go to the east.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there, and also how you contour this and things like that would give you different pictures. Okay, all right. So let's just think about what happens when a slab interacts with an LLSVP. Oh, did I point out? Here's this big LLSVP. Okay, this might matter in terms of why this thing is sitting here, right? And when it got there. Okay. So this is a paper that just came out last week by Wang et al., which includes Mike Gernis. And I think that it's telling that this looks a lot like Ertan's model in terms of a very simple initial geometry. All right? So this is an initial case. This is north, this is south. So north, east, southwest. Here's an initial LLSVP. Okay? And here's a slab, right? And in one case, they assume the slab is dipping from the north to the south. And in the other case, they assume the slab is dipping from the south to the north, right? This is the geometry we see in the seismic tomography. This is the opposite, okay? And this is the temperature structure, and then this is the viscosity structure, okay? So you have here a hot thing that's actually viscous because of its composition, okay? And they did several different cases, and I'll just show you the two. Right. The top one is the one that started out with the slab that was initially dipping to the north. And this is the one that started out with the slab initially dipping to the south. Okay. That really messes up our ability to interpret seismic tomography in terms of motion. Okay. geometry does not tell you the path that thing took to where it is now. All right? What does this actually imply? Right? This slab started out like this, and basically this part sank more slowly because it was getting basically pushed upwards by the flow induced by the LLSVP. This part was able to sink more quickly, and so the dip just changes. It's a simple model, yes, Torsten. And Diogo also has a comment. No, it is movable, right? You can see it's deformed. Well, no, okay, that's fine. But there's a global model in the next picture. Do you want the global model?
Can I just say something? You still need the slab, right?
What?
You still need a slab to come yes. from somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, but there was a subduction zone in the middle of that area, but dipping basically to the northwest.
I'd just like to say also the viscosity contrast between the LLSVP and the ambient mantle here is two orders of magnitude, right? And actually, if you just assumed purely temperature dependence, you'd expect something like two orders of magnitude in the opposite direction.
Right, yes. So they're assuming a compositional effect in order to keep the LLSVP stable.
Yeah, of four orders of magnitude, which is, yeah, maybe it's possible.
Right. Well, this is their one hypothesis for why LLSVPs are stable, right? What keeps, if you have a hot thing down there, how do you keep it down there? Right? It's one hypothesis.
You can do it with no temperature dependence at all, or with no composition prefactor.
Right? So just a purely compositional pile.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. Then it wouldn't be moving up, right? Right. I'm trying to figure out whether that makes a difference in terms of this response. Okay, the important thing here is that the LLSVP ends up inducing an upward flow above it. Okay, that ends up being so. Here it does it because it's warmer, but the buoyancy is being basically. And the viscosity is helping to keep it down. It tempers how much it can actually move up.
And it tempers the slab's ability to interact with it in any way, right?
Yes, right. Well, in terms of its because of viscosity.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. No, that's important. Yeah.
Yeah. So this discussion, a lot of the things we've seen earlier. And you pointed this out several times. Go back to the viscosity contrast between the slab and the ambient mantle or other things.
Right.
And I would just like to say it again that we basically don't know at all the temperature dependence of viscosity in the lower mantle.
Right, yeah.
And actually also this group using some different inversion method, they prefer a solution where the viscosity, the temperature dependence of viscosity is very small.
Right.
So then it gets more easy to buckle slabs. Maybe that's good news. But on the other hand, if you want slabs to stagnate or to hang around for a long time in the lower mantle, then you need to do something to the buoyancy. So as you pointed out, the alpha goes down, or if the viscosity,
right.
If the composition of the lower mantle changes, then you can get...
The relative densities will be different.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I'm not really saying that this is the answer. I'm using the model is important in terms of illustrating what kinds of things we should think about in terms of what can happen. Right? There's an interaction between these structures in the lower mantle. Some of them are clearly upwelling or inducing upwelling because we see plumes around them. Right? So there's some upwelling flow. Maybe that's a shorter length scale flow than what this is. But there is definitely, if you have a region that is basically an upwelling return flow, and you start out with the slab, you should realize that you can actually invert the shape of the slab, right? One part can sink slower than the other part because you have an upwelling flow underneath it. Okay? Yeah.
I'm now completely lost.
Okay.
Wouldn't you want to study this in the Pacific Ocean where you have subductions all around and potentially slabs coming into the Pacific LLSVP?
All of those slabs are dipping in the other direction.
Where?
They're all dipping away from the LLSVP. So the idea here is that this one actually started out dipping towards the LLSVP.
But then the next question is, how confident are you that there is a slap in the Indian Ocean which is basically anchored against the African Craton and then potentially the African LLSVP?
That's a question for the seismic, for the tomography, right? So if so, let me just show two other slides and I'll show the final seismic tomography model. So they did, this group went from this simple model, right, this testing this hypothesis, to a global model with all the caveats of imposing plate reconstructions, starting out at a certain time in which you have to put in an initial slab, and then they ran this model forward in time. So you have the surface plate motions, they put in an initial very simple LLSVP with an initial slab, okay, assuming that it has this very shallow dip, okay, and it sort of has stagnated basically somewhere in the upper mantle. Okay, and then they run this forward in time with the surface plate motions, and this is a 3D slab now, right? It's not a 2D slab, right? This is just a cross section, and they run this forward in time, and then this is the final temperature anomaly, right? And you can see this is the current present day subduction along Java, Sumatra, where the slab is. Okay, and the final picture they show is this is the seismic tomography model. In a different color scale than the other picture. Here is that size anomaly, okay? And then these are a bunch of different models in which they either, you know, get something that's relatively in the same place but actually extends as a bigger anomaly. Some of them end up in totally the wrong place, right? But there's a family of models that they show with different assumptions in terms of where this thing would end up, okay? So I'm not saying this is the answer, okay? But it's intriguing. When this observation first came out, people were basically saying, did we miss a subduction zone in the middle of the Indian Ocean? Whereas this group basically said is, maybe we start with the plate reconstructions we have and ask what the impact is of having the LLSVP, right? Given the assumptions of how they think an LLSVP is stabilized at the lower mantle, all right? So, yeah, all right? So that's my last slide. Basically, I have a couple of takeaways from the whole talk. So I think there's lots of examples, I hope, that I showed you that show that geometry is not path. And so this means that it's, so slab deformation in the lower mantle is probably more complicated than just thinking as everything is vertically sinking into the mantle. We have to think about the larger scale flow, whether those slabs are folded and piled up, which allows them to move more quickly, or whether they were flat-lying slabs in the first place, in which they will sink more slowly. I think these kinds of sort of regional focused subduction models are starting to think about the interaction between the upper mantle and the lower mantle, and this will hopefully allow us to start bridging with people who look at much longer term global mantle convection models, like what Maxine's group is doing and others who look at large scale mantle convection, Caroline's group, all right? Before that, we couldn't really talk to each other because slabs were sinking into empty mantle, right? Simple models can often be used to determine first order controls, and then you could start to ask hypothesis. What if the composition is different? What if there's post-perovskite? What if the rheology is different? You don't always have to jump to a super realistic, you know, plate reconstruction global model in order to ask questions, okay? But more sophisticated models are needed when you want to start doing direct comparison observations, right? And I think that actually trying to couple the modeling with the observations is a way to really start testing hypotheses for what, you know, what are these anomalies we see in the lower mantle and how did they get there? All right, I'll stop. Thank you. Two other questions, I think, and then Diego. Okay.
What happens if you have a sediment layer on these plates in these models, and does it just get stripped away in the upper mantle, or does it kind of get pulled down to the lower mantle as well?
So I don't know the answer to the question because none of the models have the resolution to answer that question. What I can tell you is that when we have like a basaltic layer, which is like a 7.5 kilometer thick layer, if that layer can be transported through the upper mantle quite easily, right? In particular, if you assume that the basalt rheology becomes strong when it becomes eclogite, right? So it can make it through the upper mantle, but then other things start happening. It's more buoyant, its rheology might change. So then I don't know. And so sediments are going to be kind of more difficult than that. But it's probably going to, I think you have to start figuring out what happens at a much smaller scale to figure out how they would get transported. They could also just be entrained, right? Not really part of the slab, but be pulled down with the rest of the slab flow. Depends on their buoyancy.
Completely unrelated question. What does it take to have a slab rollback? And I saw you use the term trench rollback, and what difference do you make? I'm thinking about Cascadia.
So how do you control, what causes trench rollback? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, well, and what difference do you make between trench rollback and slab rollback?
Okay, so slab rollback meaning that you go from a shallow slab to just a steeply dipping slab, but the trench doesn't move. And trench rollback meaning really the trench is moving backwards. Is that what you're asking, the difference between those two things?
If you make a difference, and then what is the mechanism to explain that people invoke to have a slab rollback in the Cascadia?
So I'm not familiar with specifically with Cascadia, but a slab can basically go from like a shallow dip to a steep dip. It can pivot, right? So if you have a plastic rheology, the slab can basically just bend like this. And that can happen without rollback, okay? But you can also have this thing steepening down while also rolling back. It ends up with a different geometry of the slab, right? If you have rollback of the trench, you end up getting a more shallow dipping slab. Whereas if the slab is just rolling backwards, you end up with a steep slab. But probably, if you have trench rollback, you also have some rollback of the slab with that. It's hard to do not both. Okay, so I don't know about Cascadia. I don't know what Cascadia is doing.
Maureen?
I'm not so sure it's so well known how the deep mantle dynamics part of that played into. I mean, it is known, I think, fairly well that the trench, the Cascadia trench, started moving back roughly around the time of the CRB flood basalts. And because we see geological evidence for opening in the back arc, right? I'm not so sure it's so well known what went on in the mantle to cause that.
Okay.
Do you know what the time scale is that a thermo anomaly from a slab should disappear?
Square root of KT is the length scale, so we can go L over. I'm not exactly sure. They're really cold. And they.
It's about 300 million.
300 million. Roughly, okay. 300 million years. Okay. Sujoy, and then, sorry? Or maybe your student first, and then Sujoy? And go around the room that way.
Related, if you have a slab wall, or whatever that was called,
uh-huh.
Will that drastically change the time scale at which that anomaly is expected to persist?
Yeah, well, so the geometry is important for how quickly it cools off. So if you have a really narrow slab, it can basically equilibrate with the mantle around it much more quickly than if you pile it up and make it a big blob. Yeah.
On a slightly different note, you showed the image from Fukawa's paper, and I'm always struck by what a large fraction of the slab seems to be between 600 and 1,000 kilometers. Because naively, I would expect you should expect a continuous distribution from the transition zone all the way down to the CMB if the slabs are just stopping temporarily and then slowly sinking into the lower mantle.
Right, yeah. So they can also break off, right? And once you've made it flat, right, it actually sinks really, really slowly. I mean, it kind of means, it goes back to my Stokes fear being kind of appropriate. because you only have a 100 kilometer thick thing. Maybe if it folded a little bit as it was being laid down, it's 200 kilometers, right? But it is, a flat slab will sink much more slowly, and it also, remember that it has to cross the 660 to feel the phase transition, right? The effect of the phase transition.
I was just wondering why you don't see a continuous distribution between 1,000 and the CMB.
Yeah.
Are you kind of losing the seismic signal, or?
You might also, yeah, you might be losing it. It's history. When did subduction actually start? And then, if you lose the seismic signal.
Just to comment on that, I think this is a very good point and a long-standing observation to some extent that we're losing some of the slab signal somewhere around 1,500 kilometers, and we've been sort of discussing for 20 years why that is, and it gets really complicated because the mineral physics is telling you should be seeing different amounts of signal in tomography, and there are also good reasons, Magali said, that you know, tectonically, you wouldn't have constant slab flux over time, but the episodes where you have more vigorous subduction and episodes where it's less vigorous, and those might be related to certain tectonic phenomena like orogeny.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to make those links directly, and I think we spend a lot of time talking about sinking velocities, and something I've been obsessing about for years, and I think when you go back, the one strong constraint we have is, as you said, that slabs seem to be slowing down in the lower mantle, and Carolina and Mark Richards and Yannick Ricard made that argument, right? If you decrease the sinking speed in the lower mantle, you improve the match to tomography.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much where we are, because all those other models that try to include lateral advection are doing slightly better than just letting things drop and slow them down, but not that much more, that much better. And we said this at the last CIDR, but it's I think it is embarrassing and an important problem that speaks to our lack of knowledge about the mass transport. I mean, we talked about the Van der Meer stuff. We have these really low sinking velocities, and those are averages, right? They don't take this into account. They have one slope, and then it's pretty slow, but presumably it's fast in the upper mantle, slow in the lower mantle.
Yeah.
But how important are those lateral transport processes you alluded to? Well, even our best forward models only match tomography up to degree 5 or so, which is huge length scales. And when you look in detail, right, we don't get the match that Van der Meer and others invoke. Right, we do not have the forward models that would predict, you know, slab locations accurately for some reason, 120 years, 20 million years ago. And of course, that goes back to the uncertainties in both, say, slab rheology and plate reconstructions.
Right.
And the answer is we need to do it all better. But it's really uncertain.
Yeah. But I think one thing these questions about sort of how long does the thermal equilibration take and things like that are getting to is sort of, you know, what's the oldest slab that we would see in the lower mantle, right? Is it 200 million years ago, 250, 300, you know? It's the recent past, right?
It's not that long. To realize that some of those reconstructions are driven by people who have an interest that the answer to Magali's question is really long, right? Because they would like to have a reference that goes beyond, 500 million years if possible.
Right.
And so one can argue if 200 is way too long, right?
Yeah,
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think 120 is a better number. But so just keep in mind that when people do these exercises, there's sometimes a not so hidden agenda.
Yeah. I think we should probably go take a picture and have coffee. I'm happy to keep talking.